This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Our guest James Franco stars with Sean Penn in the movie Milk, which has just come out on DVD. Penn plays Harvey Milk, who became the first gay man elected to public office in the U.S. when he won a seat on San Francisco's Board of Supervisors in 1977. Before completing his first year in office, he was assassinated by fellow supervisor Dan White. James Franco plays Milk's lover, Scott Smith. In this scene, Milk has just picked up Scott at a New York subway station. They're in bed together talking, and Milk says he's still in the closet and that he's scared of losing his job.
Where are you from?
Jackson, Mississippi.
This isn't Jackson. You can't respond to just every strange man that picks you up on a subway platform. It's too dangerous.
Well, now you tell me.
New York police are the toughest. They're arrogant, and they're everywhere. I'll show you all the cruising spots, but you have to be very careful, little Scotty side.
Are you on uppers or something?
No. This is just plain me.
And you're scared of the cops?
I'm just discreet. I know a lot of people. If they see me, I could lose my job.
Oh, you're one of those. Well, I think you need to find a new scene. Some new friends.
The pair soon moved to San Francisco, set up a camera shop in the Castro District, and helped transform the neighborhood into the gay capital of the city. James Franco co-starred in the short-lived but terrific TV series Freaks and Geeks. After playing the rebellious high school heartthrob in that series, he played the ultimate rebellious heartthrob, James Dean, in a telemovie about the iconic actor. And Franco starred with Seth Rogen in last summer's comedy Pineapple Express, the stoner action film, which is now also out on DVD. Terry spoke with Franco last November when Milk was in theaters.
Are we past the point where I have to ask if it's risky to play a gay character and if that could adversely affect your career?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, it certainly seems like, times have changed. I think as far as straight actors playing gay roles, Brokeback Mountain was a big breakthrough. I'm pretty sure when they were casting that movie that I think the story is like, 10 to 15 other actors turned it down. I don't know if that's true or not. But after that movie, I think some of the hesitancy of straight actors to, play gay roles has been dissipated. But I had no fear of playing this role.
Did Gus Van Sant want to get assurances from you that you'd be okay kissing Sean Penn in scenes?
Well, I read the script, so I knew it was coming. So I guess one thing that happened was that after I agreed to do the script, there was a rewrite. And I read the rewrite, and one of the changes were that there were more kissing scenes, and there was, like, a big love scene on, like, page 5. And, I was all prepared for the other scene, kissing scenes, but I said, well, Gus, well, you're adding more. What's going on? And he was very smart, and he said, Sean Penn is going to be playing a gay character, and you're playing, you're both straight actors playing gay characters. And in the back of people's minds are probably going to be thinking, like, all right, when is Sean going to kiss a dude? And so you might as well just get it out of the way so people can get beyond it and, really engage with the story. And I think he was right.
Yeah, that's
I can tell,
really
I can tell you a little bit more about the kissing if you want.
Yeah, go ahead.
Funny
yeah,
thing
yeah.
is... right before we started filming in San Francisco, there was a show at the SF MoMA of this artist, Douglas Gordon, a great artist. He does everything, but some of his best pieces are his video pieces. And this was it was called, like, Everything Up Until Now. And it was all of his video pieces in one room. And so Gus went with his DP, Harris Savides. And there was one piece where this couple was kissing, a young man and young woman were kissing on the street, and I think it lasted about 3 minutes, and Gus told me the story later. He turned to Harris and he said, wow, look at that. kiss. It's so natural. It looks so real. You know, that's what we need for the movie. You know, we don't want movie kisses. We want our actors to look real when they're kissing. How do you think Douglas did that? And Harris said, like, well, you know, they're probably really kissing. It's just a couple that he saw kissing and shot him. And that night, Gus had dinner with Douglas Gordon. I guess they knew each other. They both had done Psycho pieces. You know, Gus remade the movie, and Douglas has this piece called 24 Hours Psycho, where he slowed Psycho down.
Oh, right, right. I read about
so
that.
So it would last 24 hours. Mm-hmm. So he asked Douglas, you know, how'd you get that kiss to look so real? It must have been just a couple you shot, right? And Douglas said, no, I hired two actors who didn't know each other, and I had them kiss for 12 hours, and then I took the best 3 minutes and put it in there. So Gus told me the story, and he said, so, yeah, you and Sean, huh? And I knew he was kind of kidding, but not exactly, because the Douglas Gordon piece actually, like, inspired this shot in the movie that hadn't been in the script, where Sean and I are just on the sidewalk, like, kissing for, like, at least a full minute. I don't think it's a minute in the film, but the takes were, like, at least a minute, if not longer. And that, I don't think I've ever kissed anybody on camera for that long. And in addition to that, there were, like, 300 people out on Castor Street behind the camera just watching. And it was, you know, the first kiss that was filmed in the movie. So it felt like there was a lot of pressure on that kiss. And I think, you know, you can kind of just make your mind blank for about 30 seconds. But, you know, after that, I really think I thought, well, here I am kissing Spicoli. I was just thinking, that's really what I thought. Like, wow, I was thinking of Sean Penn in the beach, you know, in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Uh-huh. Just like, hey, dude, yeah, I saved Brooke Shields or whatever. And that's what I was thinking. And, like, I cannot believe that I went from a kid watching that to this. And
well, Sean Penn is such, like, the method actor. Did you both, like, talk through the scene before doing it? And did he prepare for it differently than you prepared for it?
Well, I mean, you don't really prepare for a kissing scene. I've been asked that a lot, like, did you and Sean do preparation and that kind of thing? And if you think about it, like, if I said to one of my female co-stars on another movie, like, hey, why don't we go rehearse this love scene in my hotel room a bit? I don't think it would fly. And so you just don't really rehearse kissing scenes, whether it's male or female. And there's not really much to talk about. You know, you kind of both know how to kiss, you assume, and you just do it. I guess if I think Sean took some breath mints and you just do it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor James Franco. This summer, you starred in Pineapple Express, which I just thought was a wonderful film. And you starred in it with Seth Rogen. And you're like the real stoner in the movie. Well, you both are. But you're the person who, like, sells the marijuana.
I'm the dealer, yes.
You're the dealer. And you're selling, like, really potent stuff called Pineapple Express. And let's just start with a clip.
That was a good voice right there. Yeah.
Let's just start with a clip from the film. And this is from early in the movie. Seth Rogen is a process server. His job is to hand deliver legal papers to people. And okay. And you're the dealer. So he shows up at your door one day to buy some marijuana from you. And he's on his way to, like, serving a subpoena. So he's wearing a suit. And you're surprised to see him that dressed up. Here's the scene.
What's up with the suit?
Well, I'm a process server, so I have to wear a suit.
Wow. You're a servant? Like, a butler? A chauffeur?
No, what? No, I'm not, like, no, I'm
shine shoes?
I'm a process server. I, like,
in process.
I work for a company that's, like, hired by lawyers to, like, hand out legal documents, like subpoenas to people who don't want them, so I gotta
subpoena.
Wear, like, disguises sometimes just to make them admit that they're themselves so I can serve them the papers.
Disguise?
Kind of, I guess. It's a hell of a job.
That's cool, man.
Like a day-to-day basis, it's fine. Like,
you got a great job where you don't do anything?
That's what I say.
I wish I had that.
Are you kidding? You do. You have the easiest job on earth.
That's true.
You didn't think of that. No.
I do have a good job.
Yeah, you do nothing.
Thanks, man.
No problem.
You are so funny in this film. I mean, you're so kind of like sweet and dumb at the same time. And there's some incredible.
But I have high aspirations. I want to be. I want to be an architect.
Yeah.
Of some sort and build. Highway off ramps and septic tanks.
And you have some great moments of physical comedy in it. You take a lot of physical abuse in this movie.
Yeah. As far as the physical abuse, you know, I had a feeling going into the movie that there would be some injuries just because, you know, I'd been on like the Spider-Man movies that. Mm-hmm. You know, have very big budgets. I think Spider-Man 3 had one of the biggest budgets ever. And you take a lot of time to do those action scenes. Like, you know, we take a month or more to do one action scene in Spider-Man. On Pineapple Express, you know, I'm reading the script and there's like a lot of action for a comedy. I mean, they call it an action comedy. But there's, you know, there wasn't a huge budget and there wasn't a lot of time to do them. And I knew in the back of my mind, I was thinking, oh, man, we are going to get hurt. And the actors ended up doing, you know, we ended up doing a lot of our own stunts. And, you know, I don't know, ran into a tree. There's a scene where we're running through the woods and I run into a tree. Well, I actually ran into the tree. But not only that, there was a pad on the tree that I guess was supposed to protect me, but it was screwed in with exposed washers in each corner. And So I not only hit the tree, I hit like a washer. So I had like a, and the reason I knew I hit the washers, the cut was crescent shaped. And and so it was kind of, I guess, my fault, but, you know, the guy, whatever. But, and then Seth, like, I think he sprained his finger. He had to go to the hospital for his finger. There's a scene where I hit Danny over the head with a bong. And, yeah, it was a breakaway bong. But by that point, I mean, I even warned Danny McBride. I was like, look, by the, you know, just based on the way things have been going, I'm going to hit you in the right spot, but I think you're going to get hurt. And he's like, do it. And I guess because it was, you know, weighted with water or something, sure enough, like as soon as I hit him, you look at him in the scene because it's the take that he actually got hit, and his eyes like do look like really dilated or something. But I think it was worth it just because we're not. One thing that can happen with stuntmen is they're very, you know, they're well trained at, you know, with fighting and movie fighting, and so they look very slick when they're fighting. We don't necessarily look that slick, you know, and so the fights become comedic.
James Franco speaking with Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with actor James Franco. He starred opposite Sean Penn in the movie Milk, which is now out on DVD.
Seth Rogen, who you starred with in Pineapple Express, is someone you met in your first big role, which is in the series Freaks and Geeks, the sadly short-lived series Freaks and Geeks, which was set in high school. And that's where you also met Paul Feig and Judd Apatow. How did you get the part in Freaks and Geeks? Were you still in high school or just out of high school?
No, Seth, I think, was still in high school. I don't think he finished high school.
Yeah, right, exactly. He dropped out, I think.
Yeah, he's one of the smartest dropouts I've ever met. I was a little older. I was, I think, 20 when I auditioned. And, you know, I'd done little things here and there. I think I did, like, Pacific Blue, which was, like, Baywatch on, like, bikes and rollerblades and stuff like that. And, you know, little bits here and there. And they just did a huge casting call. I think they met a lot of young actors. And they were really smart. They had a script for the pilot, but I think they just looked for actors that they really liked and not really people that would fit their script exactly. So my character in the script didn't have a last name, just Daniel. And the description, I still have it, the original draft. It says Daniel, he's Latino with the Peter Frampton hair. And so I'm not exactly that. And but they just liked me, and they put me in that role. And then when the show got picked up, they changed the name to Daniel DiSario, so I guess I became Italian. And then they kind of wrote the characters around the actors, although I wasn't exactly like Daniel in high school, but I guess they thought I could play that guy well.
Were the scripts and the storylines at all like your high school experiences growing up in Palo Alto?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I got in a lot of trouble. I mean, it was silly trouble. I guess as much trouble as you can get in Palo Alto.
For what?
I got arrested for graffiti. I got arrested for a lot of underage drinking, drunk in public, shoplifting, your various, suburban arrests, I guess.
Okay, well, let's stop for a moment. What did you shoplift?
Oh gosh, that was ridiculous. I don't know. For some reason, when I was in junior high school, my friends and I had a cologne stealing ring.
So, cologne?
Well, yeah. I didn't even really wear it, but and it's kind of, I guess it's ironic. I just did the Gucci cologne ad, and I was the cologne thief in junior high. We would go around to all the department stores, and they have the tester bottles out on the counter, so it was really easy to steal. And then we take them to school and keep them in our gym locker and sell them to people. And for a while, it was really hip to wear Dracar Noir and stuff like that. And we could sell it.
It was a cologne smuggling ring.
Yeah, and then one day the assistant principal found out about it and went into the locker room and busted our lockers open with a crowbar, and we were caught. And actually, I think I was on vacation or something. I don't know why I was gone from school, but I was in Hawaii, and he had called the police, and they thought I had jumped the city or whatever, and bailed out of town to get away from my cologne stealing.
Well, I want to play a scene from Freaks and Geeks. The series is set in high school, and there's a girl in Freaks and Geeks who has a real crush on you, and she's very smart, and you're not a good student. And in this episode, she's tutoring you for a math test. And what you do is that you steal a copy of the test so that you have the answers in advance. And then you want her to help you cover up. And so you're kind of explaining to her how she has to help you do this, and she kind of realizes that you're playing her and will pick it up from there.
Yeah.
You're manipulating me.
What?
You're manipulating me.
I'm not.
Yes, you are. And you know, it's really hard to say no to you, but I have to. I'm sorry, I can't go in there and lie. I'm not going
to. Okay, fine. Don't lie.
What?
No, let's go in there. We'll tell them what we did. What's the difference? You'll get a nice slap on the wrist, and I'll get what? Suspended? Expelled?
That is not fair, Daniel.
What do you think? I want to be terrible at school? You think I like it? I wish I was as smart as you. I wish it all came easy to me. But it doesn't. No, when I was in sixth grade, they told us when we got to junior high, we'd be either in track one, track two, or track three. Track one's the smart kids. Track two's the normal kids. Track three is the dumb kids. And what do you think I got? How do you think it feels to be told you're dumb when you're 11 years old?
You are not dumb.
I just wanted to prove them wrong. Just once.
That's actually a really funny scene because we learn later that this is the speech you give to people when you're trying to get their sympathy and get off the hook and not take responsibility for your actions. It's all acting. And really, I thought that scene was your character kind of borrowing from James Dean, who you later played in a made-for-TV movie, and Marlon Brando in the I Could Have Been a Contender scene.
Did you
think of it that way when you were playing this?
Not really. I guess even before I played James Dean, I did love his work, and I'd study it, and Brando certainly, and Cliff, those were the big three. So maybe they were kind of influencing it, or I'd certainly seen all the Dean movies and On the Waterfront, probably 50 times each by that point. But I don't know. I think I was just, I don't know, drawing on my inner dumb guy. It's weird. I play a lot of dumb guys. And what's funny is in high school, my dad works in Silicon Valley and, like, is a math freak. So he actually, like, rammed math down my throat. So I tested out of math. I didn't have to take it in college because of all the work my dad did. And thank God I haven't studied it since high school.
James Franco speaking with Terry Gross. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies filling in for Terry Gross. We're listening to Terry's interview with actor James Franco. He starred with Sean Penn in the movie Milk and with Seth Rogen in Pineapple Express. Both films are now out on DVD.
One of the things you've done over the years is a lot of really funny sketches and scenes in other people's movies in which you mock yourself or you mock serious acting. And you've done a series for the Funny or Die website.
Yeah.
Of sketches called Acting with James Franco, in which you give acting tips to your younger brother. And
yeah,
it's kind of like a send-up of acting classes and of the method. And one of them is all about, like, James Dean and Rebel Without a Cause. And you go through a scene with your brother that's a reenactment, yeah, of a scene from Rebel Without a Cause. Describe the scene that you're reenacting in this.
Oh, yeah, there's a scene in Rebel where James Dean gives Sal Mineo his jacket, and you know, back in the 50s, I guess you couldn't be explicit about gay characters, and so it's not that subtle, but Sal's character is kind of in love with Dean's character, and so when Sal takes the jacket, I guess he kind of like sniffs it or like rubs it on his face or something, like, adoringly. And so the joke was that I was going to, you know, make my brother perform that exact action.
You're bullying him into adoring you. And so I just want to play that scene from your Funny or Die video.
Just rub the jacket against your face and smell it.
Why would I want to smell the jacket and rub it against my face?
Because that's what he did, because he's in love with James Dean.
This is typical, man. You give me the worst characters again, and you get to be James Dean, of course. Of course you get to be James Dean.
Of course I get to be James Dean. Who else is going to be James Dean?
You're such a good actor, you can play him, and I'll play James Dean.
You can't play James Dean. I'm James Dean. Actors sniff jackets.
Okay.
Actors act, actors sniff jackets if they need to sniff jackets. Marlon Brando sniffed jackets.
Okay.
He sniffed pants.
Oh...
He did.
Okay.
You're a rebel without a cause. What's your cause? Not sniffing jackets? Sniff it.
You sniff it.
Okay. You sniff it.
Nope.
Just what I thought.
Okay.
You don't know how to act.
I think that's so funny. Is he really your younger brother, the person who's
doing this? Yeah. That's Davey, my younger brother. We were, I went to UCLA. He went to USC, and he started acting a couple years ago, and he's been doing pretty well.
I think you're also in the Funny or Die videos, the James Franco on acting. You're kind of sending up acting school and acting pretensions. Like, there's one in which you're teaching your brother how to cry and how to, like, use an emotion from within. And every time he comes up with an emotion, you're telling him, no, that's too trivial. You can't use that. It's so kind of clueless and insulting. It's really funny. Were there a lot of acting pretensions that bothered you when you were in acting school?
I learned a lot of good things in my school. I've audited a lot of other schools, and I guess after a while, I got a little tired of the acting school atmosphere. As an actor in the classroom, you're revealing so much, and teachers are, you know, they're not just critiquing like a painting or a piece of work. It's like it's you and it's your emotions that they're working with, and so it becomes a very weird kind of intimate space. And there's some, like, acting schools, thank goodness, not the one I was at, but, you know, they'll ask things like, in front of the whole class, like, have you ever had an abortion? You know? And it's just like, what? Wow. And so I learned a lot of good things, but after a while it was too much.
Now, I read that you do so much research for films that, for instance, for the movie Flyboy, you earned your pilot's license. For the movie Annapolis, you did 8 months of boxing training, and for the movie Tristan and Isolde, you studied sword fighting for 8 months, and all of these movies were flops. So what's the moral of the story in terms of like committing to incredible research for a film? Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, the moral. Well, you know, I went into Annapolis as a young actor hoping that it would be Raging Bull. Now, that sounds kind of ridiculous, but that's how I tried to apply myself. You know, I'd box every day for 8 months. I would, you know, spar with pros. I mean, you know, they went very, very easy on me and actually, like, you know, hurt me sometimes when they weren't going so easy. But, you know, I worked as hard as I could with the intention of making, you know, a movie with, you know, and the best is that, oh, yeah, it'd be like a young Raging Bull. But it wasn't. I mean, that wasn't the movie. I was ridiculous in thinking that it would be something like that. It was a completely different kind of story. And so no matter how hard I worked, I could have boxed for 5 years. It was never going to be that. And so I guess now it's a matter of being really clear about what kind of movie I'm getting into. And you know, I still work really hard, but I like to think I'm a little smarter about at least the type of movie I'm getting into. And if it turns out to be a failure, at least, you know, a box office failure, at least I start movies with people that I believe in and people with visions, you know, that I believe in. And so if it doesn't kind of come together in the right way, at least I was doing it because I believed in the person in the movie.
James Franco, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was great.
James Franco and Terry Gross recorded in November. Franco's films Milk and Pineapple Express are now out on DVD. Historian and civil rights advocate John Hope Franklin died Wednesday in Durham, North Carolina. He was 94. Franklin was a prolific scholar, perhaps best known for his book From Slavery to Freedom, regarded as one of the definitive accounts of the African-American experience. He was also intensely involved in the political and social issues confronting Black America, working over the years with W.E.B. Du Bois, Martin Luther King, and Thurgood Marshall. Born and raised in an all-Black community in Oklahoma, Franklin experienced humiliating incidents of discrimination growing up. He attended the historically Black Fisk University in Nashville and went on to teach at Harvard, the University of Chicago, and Duke, breaking several color barriers over the course of his academic career. Later in life, he chaired President Clinton's Initiative on Race and was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. Terry spoke to John Hope Franklin in 1990.
You were often in the position of researching segregation or researching slavery in libraries and archives that were segregated.
Yes.
Give us an example of some of the obstacles you faced there.
Well, when I arrived in North Carolina in the spring of 1939 to do research on free Negroes in North Carolina in the State Department of Archives and History, I went in to see the director of the archives one Monday morning, and I told him that I was there to do research. He said, well, very frankly, when we built this building, we had no idea that anyone of your color would ever be coming here to do research, and therefore we don't have any facilities for you. Then he paused, and I looked at him. He said, but I suppose that you have a right to be here, and the only thing I ask you to do is to give me some time, during which time I can make some arrangements. He said, give me a week. Well, I was down there paying room rent and paying for my meals, and I thought that was a long time just to loaf around at my expense. And I just looked straight at him, and he knew, I suppose, what I was thinking, and he said, well, how about 3 days? And I said, well, I'll be back. And I went back at the end of the morning of the fourth day, and they had all things arranged. They had removed all of the materials out of a small display room that was used by the historical division of the archives. And they had put in there a table and a chair. And the search room was across the hall where all of the whites were doing their research and where the card catalog and all that were. And I was presented with a key to the manuscript stacks. And that was the understanding, of course, that the white attendants would not bring things to me, and therefore I would have to get them myself. Well, I would cross the hall, go into the search room, and go stick my key in the locked manuscript stacks and go in and come out with a wagon load of marvelous materials, and the whites would stop and look at me. And after 2 weeks of this, the director of the archives called me in and said, "I'm sorry, but I'll have to take your key." I said, "What's wrong? I didn't. What have I done?" He said, "It is not that you have done anything. It is that all of the other people who are doing research here are demanding keys also, so that they can go into the stacks and have the privilege that you are enjoying." I said, "They are being discriminated against, I suppose they would say." He said, "That's what they said to me." And so he lifted my key, and then he said, "Well, I will have to require the attendants now to deliver the materials to you." And so from that day on, I would merely go over to the person who had charge of the reading room, the manuscript reading room, turn in my requests for manuscripts, then retreat to my little room and wait there until the manuscripts were brought to me by attendants, who I suppose would have brought them anyway at the outset.
You said that your parents wouldn't stand for segregation when you were growing up. I mean, what did that mean exactly? Were there public places that they wouldn't go to because they didn't want to have to go to the segregated area?
Oh, yes. Neither my mother nor my father ever voluntarily segregated themselves. My father was a lawyer, as you know, and he would not tolerate segregation in the courthouse in Tulsa. When he took me to court with him, which was very often, after all, don't forget that I'm trying to apprentice as a lawyer at that point, and he would never permit me to sit where blacks were supposed to sit or expected to sit. I either sat, if it was a non-jury case, I sat in one of the seats where the jury would ordinarily be seated, or if it was a jury case, I sat at the bar, at the desk table with my father, and he simply wouldn't stand for it. Now, we lived in a city that was absolutely and completely segregated. There was not just, it was separate. It wasn't just segregation. For example, there were no movie houses in which there were white sections and black sections. There were white movie houses and black movie houses. And the same thing was true of virtually everything else. The only place that I know where there was segregation of an audience was at the convention hall. There was only one such auditorium in the city. And it was to this hall that, say, the Paul Whiteman came with the orchestra and accompanied by George Gershwin, and I think it was 26 or 27. And it was to this hall that the Chicago Civic Opera Company performed every spring. My mother and father would not even consider going to such places. But I was a music buff, and so I wanted to go. They said, "Well, you go on your own. We wouldn't go." But there were other blacks in the city that would go, and I would go with them.
Do you feel bad about going? That you were violating a family principle?
The family principle really was that one could do as one pleased at this. There was, in other words, there was permissiveness, because my parents did not think that this was an absolute cardinal sin, as it were. But it was a principle for them, which they did not insist that the children pursue. But I do even now at times reproach myself, despite the fact that I'm still an opera buff and was on the board of the Chicago Symphony for a number of years. The reason that I like this is because I experienced the humiliation of segregation in order to develop these tastes, and I don't think that's very pretty.
You know, some of your essays in your new book, you talk about some of the obstacles that you've faced as a black scholar, and you write that there's really it goes beyond any discrimination you faced in the field itself. For instance, when you were the chairman of the history department at Brooklyn College, one of the problems you had was finding a house you wanted to live in because you weren't a lot of neighborhoods just refused to sell to you.
That's right. I spent more than a year trying to find a place to purchase. After my appointment there was of such spectacular nature that my picture and a long article about the appointment was on the front page of the New York Times. But when I set out to find a house near the college, I hoped that I would be able to walk to work. Almost no real estate dealers in the area would show me any of the houses that they were widely advertising. And when I finally found one offered by the owner, then I had the problem of trying to find the money to borrow to purchase a house. And that was another round of excruciating experiences. I finally found it, but I could have spent all this time much better.
Let me ask you a kind of stupid question. Did you ever take that front page article with you to the realtors and say, look, do you know who I am?
No. No, I don't believe in that. I think that I'm a human being, and that ought to be enough to come. And I'm well-mannered, and I'm fairly well-dressed, and my conduct is, I hope, above reproach. And I think that ought to commend me. If that doesn't, well, I'm sure that they don't want to hear anything about who I am. I have no doubt that many of these people knew who I was, and yet I was still rejected.
Do you often ask yourself what your contribution to the present can be as a historian, as a scholar?
Of course. It's not enough to write race and history or any of the other 11 or 12 books that I've written. It's not enough even to teach in the great universities, as it's been my privilege to do. What one needs to do, and I say this to my students and to my friends, one needs to be an activist. One needs to do something about illiteracy. One needs to do something about these other tragic modes of conduct that we see. I'm always insisting now that if the university and if the college have been ivory towers, they cannot afford to be in our society as it is now. After having taught for 53 years, it might be difficult for me to turn to some of these more activist activities, although I hasten to add that I have done some of all of that throughout my life. I would to myself like to renew my own activities and increase them. And I call on all young people of all races and of all ethnic groups to join in, for this world is no better than the least of the people in it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Historian John Hope Franklin speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. Franklin died Wednesday. He was 94. The 34-year-old director Ramin Barani was born in North Carolina to Iranian immigrants and returned to Iran in the 90s to study its culture and filmmaking. His three feature films are set in American cities and told from the vantage of outsiders struggling to create a home. His latest is Goodbye Solo, the story of a Senegalese cab driver and a passenger whose life the cab driver thinks is in his own hands. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
So much of a movie's appeal comes down to whether you enjoy staring at the actors' faces. In Ramin Barani's Goodbye Solo, there are two you've likely never seen before, two tantalizing maps to pore over. The first belongs to Suleiman Sy Sivane. He plays Solo, a Senegalese immigrant cab driver in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. His face is wide and reddish-brown, with an indentation in his cheek the shape of a baby's foot and laughing eyes that can quickly turn quizzical. The film opens audaciously with Solo in mid-chortle. That's because a passenger of his, an old man named William, played by Red West, the other great face, has just said he'll give him $1,000 for a trip 1 week hence to a mountain with a windy overlook called Blowing Peak. That's a one-way trip, and it doesn't take a weatherman to know which way that wind blows. The implication is unmistakable. When Solo realizes it's not a joke, he sets about injecting himself into William's life, to the point of moving into the old man's motel room. Solo is studying to be a flight attendant, and he attempts to engage William in his hopeful quest.
What are you doing?
I don't even know what I'm doing right now.
Who the hell told you to come here?
You know I can't go to Navani. I mean, I just can't. And Rock is a meme, some stuff I'm not interested in. So, you know, I figured maybe for a couple of days I could, you know.
There's no room.
Big dog, this place is huge, man. In Africa, 10 people can sleep in here. 10 people. And plus, see, this is all I have. This is all I have, nothing else. See this bag? This is the only thing I have here, man. This sofa is perfect. All I need is a tiny place to study. Oh, I didn't tell you. Check this out. I'm studying for my interview. And this time I'm going all the way, man. I'm telling you, all the way. No stopping. Kira says I can do it. Why not? I can do it. Because you know what? I want to do it. That's all. So, big dog, I'm just going to chill in here and study, all right? Is that cool with you? See, I'm sitting here studying. Can you see me? You can't see me. You're chilling over there watching TV. I'm here chilling, man. You know what I'm saying? This light over here, if I turn it off and I don't smile, you're not going to do that.
Stay out of my stuff. Keep your over there and leave me alone.
Thank you very much, big dog. Thank you. That's what I'm talking about. Thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate it.
This is potentially a sentimental setup and potentially creepy, too. You have a black man who could be said to represent the life force, and he's trying to revive the white person's spirit. And that's so driving Miss Daisy, so the legend of Bagger Vance. And that big dog thing Solo does can get on your nerves as much as it gets on Williams. But Goodbye Solo never goes soft. To the end, it's a tug of war between hope and resignation, in which neither player openly acknowledges what's at stake. The suspense is terrific. The theme of a piece with Barani's other two features. His first, Man Push Cart, also centers on an industrious immigrant, a Pakistani ex-rock star with a hot dog cart in Manhattan. The movie is somewhat contrived, but gorgeously shot and evocative. The man's day-to-day rituals might threaten to grind him down, but to us, his outsider perspective on a world we thought we knew is endlessly fascinating. In Barani's grittier second film, Chop Shop, his protagonist is a prepubescent Latino orphan boy who lives above an auto repair garage and earns a living doing odd jobs, some legal, some extra legal, and you're forced to suspend your moral judgments. You watch his dogged survival with a mixture of pain and awe. You wonder how he can go on with so little positive reinforcement. In Goodbye Solo, Barani has made a true drama. Solo engages, William parries. William yields, then his defenses fly up, and he curses Solo out like the ex-biker he is. Solo keeps on. He's a hustler in the best sense. He lives the way he plays soccer, guilelessly but inexhaustibly. He has a baby on the way, a family in Senegal, big dreams of flight. Yet it's fair to tell you that in some ways he falls short of his quest to reach William. Optimism, exhortation, they can only go so far. William has been places Solo will never understand. The actor Red West's eyes have bags under bags, yet they're almost lidless, huge, and liquid. Those eyes let us in, while his harsh demeanor shuts us out. The director never gives up on William. His camera never stops searching that face. But he finally respects its mystery. The greatness of Goodbye Solo is in both faces. It's a film of overflowing humanism, yet it acknowledges, in grief and wonder, that some things can never be reconciled.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.